This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Behind door number one, legislative chaos. Behind door number two, government shutdown. Behind door number three, well, we don't really know now, do we? And therein lies the problem. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, today the 27th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. With all respect to my political reporter colleagues and to devotees of political news in general, of which, full disclosure, I am one, all y'all are talking a lot about deadlines this week. Deadlines on the two infrastructure packages and deadlines on funding the government after Thursday. But honestly, we know what happens if those deadlines get blown. The government shuts down, partially. Not great, embarrassing even, but we know what to do. And the infrastructure packages, I mean, legislative deadlines, and that's in air quotes, they come and go all the time. You know what deadline we've never really seen the other side of? The one where Congress, Republicans, to be clear, won't agree to borrow more money so that we can pay the debts we have already rung up. There be economic dragons, and we don't really have a playbook for that. Although Marketplace's Kimberly Adams did spend the day looking for one.
Right now, the government's income isn't enough to cover its expenses, so it keeps borrowing to cover the difference. But hitting the debt limit is like hitting the limit on a credit card. The government won't be able to borrow anymore. It would have to choose between paying its bills and paying back the money it's already borrowed. Shai Acabas is an economist at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
There's really no way that you could stave off all of the consequences from the federal government starting to miss payments, mostly because they're located in the financial markets.
And that makes it hard to predict what will happen. For example, the government could make a choice to try to stabilize markets by emphasizing paying down debt. But, says Bernard Yaros, an economist at Moody's Analytics,
bondholders are going to realize this is not politically tenable to keep paying principal and interest before Social Security recipients, military and veterans, and everyone else in the country.
Folks at the Fed and Treasury are probably scrambling to prepare what-if scenarios, says Howell Jackson, a law professor at Harvard, like prioritizing debt or paying everyone really slowly.
But I should emphasize that we really don't know how it would work and whether they should do it. And I think it's important for everyone to recognize that this is very dangerous territory.
And he says it would be much better for Congress just to avoid it altogether. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We will get a sense of home prices tomorrow with the release of the latest Case-Shiller Home Price Index. Of related interest, if you will, how much the money you have to borrow to buy that house is going to cost you. Mortgage rates, although ticking up just a touch, are still near historic lows. So Marketplace's Amanda Peacher does the real estate math.
For buyers who've been trying to get into a house for a while now, higher mortgage interest rates might not be a terrible thing in this market, says Christopher Thornburg of Beacon Economics.
Big spike in interest rates would cause the market to cool down and cool down sharply for quite some period of time.
But rates are still very low now, so we're a ways away from a cool down. And right now, Thornburg says the housing market is still a bit nuts because of the pandemic.
Everybody who was even thinking about buying a home was running around with their head cut off, throwing money at anything.
Demand is high because there aren't enough homes on the market for buyers who want them. And that won't change immediately, even if interest rates rise. In that case, Holden Lewis with NerdWallet says would-be buyers adjust their expectations.
When mortgage rates go up, then they shop for slightly cheaper houses.
That's true for freelance writer Lindsay Van Summeren in Washington State. She's been trying to buy a house since July, but has been watching prices go up.
Like when I was a kid, I thought like if you were to tell me I was going to spend $600,000 to $800,000 on a home, I would have thought it would be a castle.
She still really wants a house, so if rates increase, Van Summeren has a plan.
And I'm just going to have to like have a glass of wine with me or something. I'm not quite sure.
That's to brace herself for that first mortgage statement and seeing the huge chunk of her payment that goes to interest. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little of this, a little of that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Don't know if you saw it, but the Wall Street Journal had an amazing series a week or two ago, laying out in detail what Facebook knows about the effects its platform and its policies are having on this society. And in one installment in particular, how harmful Instagram, which is, of course, owned by Facebook, can be to teenage girls, with one in three saying Instagram made them feel bad about their bodies and many users reporting increased anxiety and depression. Correlation is not causation, but today, Instagram said it's taking a pause on plans to launch a version of its Instagram app for kids. The company says it does still plan to go ahead with a safe app for kids under 13, but is such thing possible or even advisable? Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
Instagram's pausing but not giving up on an app for kids. In a blog post, the head of Instagram, Adam Mosseri, said kids under 13 are already online, misrepresenting their ages and downloading apps meant for older teens and adults. Megan Moreno, a pediatrician who studies social media's impact on adolescent health at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, isn't buying it.
Kids are going to eat candy anyways, but that doesn't mean that in school cafeterias we provide them endless of access to candy. So I'm not sure if that argument completely holds up.
There's another challenge for a kids-only app, says Amanda Lenhart with the Data and Society Research Institute in New York.
Often kids don't want to be in those spaces because it's more limited who they can reach. And a lot of times these sort of walled gardens for young children end up having pretty substantive problems of their own.
Consider YouTube, which came under fire when inappropriate videos kept busting through the filters on its kids app. Carrie James researches teens and social media at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. While she sees value in trying to curate content that's safe for kids, in practice,
this question gets murky since the content that makes one kid feel terrible might actually be benign or even affirming for another kid.
Because ultimately, what's good for kids can depend a lot on the kid. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
For all the not great things in this economy right now, this is not a bad time to be a new employee. If you're a shift manager at a McDonald's in Hickory, North Carolina, your new job might have come with a $500 signing bonus. If you're a new prison guard at the Tennessee Department of Correction, a $5,000 signing bonus. If you just started at Goldman Sachs, it's a good bet you're making more than your coworkers did when they started, even if when they started wasn't all that long ago. And if you're a new associate at a top law firm, you possibly got a five-figure raise before your first day. We do not, at this point, need to explain the labor shortage, do we? But companies might have some splaining to do to their more senior people who are probably wondering where their bonuses went. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains.
Early last year, Nate Tharp's boss asked him to sit in on some interviews for new job candidates. Tharp had been the only web designer on his team for 5 years. The entertainment company he was working for needed to hire another him.
They're going to report to the same person that I report to, the same manager, you know, same title as me, and going to be expected to perform, you know, more or less the same work duties.
One finalist had great experience, a good portfolio. Then Tharp's boss revealed the candidate's salary requests, 50% more than what Tharp was making.
If I'd told my fiance that, she probably would have told me to march in there and ask for the same.
Even though Tharp liked his job, he had been thinking about making a move. So after waiting out the worst of the pandemic, he marched into a new company that paid 30% more, not including the signing bonus. Lots of companies are in a squeeze now. They need to pay new workers more, but that means they often need to pay old workers more too, or they'll become ex-workers. Academics have a name for this, pay compression. And even if some staff stay without raises, that could still cause problems. Tae-Yoon Park is a professor of human resources at Cornell.
People may be a little more hesitant about, for example, sharing information or mentoring. Or helping others.
Those team-building trust falls become a much more dangerous proposition. Pay equity can also become a serious issue. But like so many things, Park says how workers handle pay differences depends on how they feel about their company and their boss. If you watch the Kelly Clarkson show, you may already be familiar with a well-known case study.
And y'all might remember my next guest, because not long ago, I featured him in one of our What I'm Liking segments, and I fell in love with him. This wonderful man gave all of his employees raises. Now they're each guaranteed to make at least $70,000 a year.
That's Kelly on her show in 2019. That wonderful man is Dan Price, CEO of Gravity Payments, a credit card processing company in Seattle. He also cut his own $1 million salary down to $70,000.
Nobody does that.
Nobody does that.
What?
Carrie Chin was head of human resources when Price made the announcement in 2015. She was slated to get a $15,000 pay bump.
I was thinking, oh my God, that's incredible. Like, I was happy for my team. I was happy for other people's team.
Not everyone shared Chin's enthusiasm. Pundits started placing bets on how soon the company would file for bankruptcy. And a couple senior employees just left.
The primary message from both of them was saying that I've worked really hard at Gravity over several years to make the compensation I'm making, and I earned that.
6 years in, though, Gravity Payments is still here, and so are most of its veteran employees. They even offered to take pay cuts when things got rough during the pandemic. But for many smaller businesses, the math is a lot tougher. Especially now.
Anything else for you besides the coffee? No?
Okay, Old Soul Company is a coffee roaster and bakery in Sacramento, California. It has a handful of cafes around the city, including this one near downtown. Co-owner Tim Jordan is down 5 cooks, bakers, and other back-of-house staff, which is a lot. He says if he offered big signing bonuses and other incentives...
All of your other chefs are going to know about that. And then now you've just... changed your wage base by a geometric factor, and you know, how much can you charge for a breakfast sandwich, right?
Jordan has raised almost everybody's wages 10 to 15% since the pandemic hit, including the new baristas Joshua Bell has trained.
All right, $3.35 for you today, dude. Thank you very much. Appreciate you.
Bell makes $16 an hour as a veteran barista. He says it doesn't bother him that new hires are making more than when he started. What matters to him are the relationships he has with his regulars.
This guy, I tell you.
I love all of you guys. That's why.
He also loves the tips. He gets to keep most of them. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Below the surface of the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, way below. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up today 71 points, 0.2%, closed at 34,869. The NASDAQ went the other way, down 77 points, about 0.5%, 14,969. S&P 500 down 12, 0.2%, 44.43. Amy told us earlier that Facebook is pausing the development of its Instagram for Kids project. Facebook still somehow managed to gain about 0.1%. Energy stocks rose as supply constraints pushed oil prices to around their highest levels in 3 years. Chevron revved up 2.3%. ExxonMobil grew 2.9%. A new survey from AAA shows that despite the pandemic, 55% of Americans are planning a vacation with at least one overnight stay before the end of the year, though one-third of respondents did say they are more likely to buy travel insurance because of the pandemic. Oh, look, bonds yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 1.49%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. All is not well in the video game industry. It has been for years now a regular in the conversations we've been having in this country around workplace toxicity and sexism and institutionalized racism. The latest high-profile example is an SEC investigation into Activision Blizzard, maker of, among other things, the Call of Duty franchise. All of that has people that make the games wanting better. And that leads me in turn to Kim Belair, who 3 years ago was working at Ubisoft, which is another big game developer.
I was just starting to see that there weren't a lot of ways forward, especially for women, especially for marginalized identities. And Sweet Baby started simply as a way for myself and, you know, two of my colleagues to kind of work in the industry together.
They did just that, founding Sweet Baby, a company that designs video game stories. And we got Kim, as you can tell, on the phone the other day. Let me quote you back to yourself from a piece you wrote last year, I guess, about this topic and Sweet Baby and all of that. And you said, you said you shouldn't have to found your own company to feel safer in this industry. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think I wrote that last year during this sweep of Me Too events happening across the industry. A lot of sexual abuse was being showcased. All these people were being named and people were realizing just how dangerous it is for women in this industry, for marginalized identities, for people who don't have a place. And I realized that, you know, as the CEO of a company and as part of my own company, I'm able to create a culture within Sweet Baby that is very, very helpful to me. I realized that, you know, that's such a small experience in the grand scheme of things. For the most part, people are in this industry are going to work for larger companies that might not have that kind of culture. And my hope is that they don't have to create, you know, that little vessel, that little submarine of safety to navigate the harsh ocean waters of prejudice and toxicity.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. My sense is most people, a lot of people are probably vaguely to more than vaguely aware of the misogyny and some of the really terrible behavior by gamers, right? Male gamers.
Yes.
Who are, it's just, there's some despicable conduct. I don't imagine that people are aware that inside the industry there is an analogy.
Yeah, I think that a lot of time people kind of know it as an idea, right? They know that it's something that exists, but a lot of the time they don't know what it looks like. And so they might say, yeah, I haven't seen this, when they don't realize that a lot of the things that affect people are microaggressions. And so I think that perception of the industry is at times either, you know, people will kind of look at it and go like, yeah, sure, there's some problems, but it's overall good. Mm-hmm. Or they look at it and they go, oh, well, I see a lot of very loud people saying a lot of very toxic and awful things. That must not be an industry for me. So I'm going to pull out of it. And so I think that part of our job is just kind of showing what we can do to fight it and showing, hey, these things, these structures need to change.
Right, right. The catch here, of course, is that you got to run a business. So here comes the business question. How is business? How you doing?
Thank you for asking. Doing very well. We announced our involvement with Insomniac's Spider-Man 2 and Wolverine. We have Suicide Squad coming up with Rocksteady. We have Goodbye Volcano High with the folks at Co-op. We're doing a lot of work. And I think that what's really, really interesting about that is that it's not something that I thought we would be able to do given the position that we have. You know, these are all creative projects at the end of the day, and I'm very heartened by the business and the clients that we've gotten because, you know, it lets us collaborate on a scale that people can really see the change that we're bringing.
Yeah, there's a chance that this question I'm going to ask is going to come off as indelicate, but bear with me here for a minute. I wonder if it's extra stressful for you to be running a business when you got to concentrate on nuts and bolts, but there's an enormous amount of subjectivity involved. If that makes any sense at all.
Oh, yeah. I think the hardest part of any creative industry is that feeling of subjectivity where, you know, if the numbers balance in an accounting job, you know you've done a good job.
Right, right.
But I can write a story and 3 years later, it's in a game and I'm just hoping it's good. You know, you end the day and sometimes you write a script and you're like, oh, man, I don't know if this is good. And then someone reads it and goes, wow, this really shines. Or something that you spend a lot of time on and someone's like, yeah, I didn't really feel anything for that. So it is a very subjective business. And I think that subjectivity makes us have to kind of be really sure about what it is that we're making, what it is that we're doing, and kind of develop a, you know, sense of storytelling that is our own and that we feel confident enough in to guide us through. But the only way that measures that success is, do clients keep coming back? Do the games resonate with people? Do the stories resonate with people? And that's all we're looking for.
Her company is called Sweet Baby. Kim Belair, she runs it, co-founded it too. Kim, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. This has been great.
There are some things we're going to need as we make our way through this energy transition, building electric cars and solar panels and wind turbines. Chief among those things we're going to need? Metals. A lot of them, and a lot of which aren't always easy to get on dry land. So some mining companies are starting to explore elsewhere. Julia Simon explains.
If you want to mine for metals deep in the ocean, a prime spot is way out in the Pacific, in between Hawaii and Mexico. Out in the high seas, you need permission to explore the seabed from this guy.
I'm in Jamaica.
You're in Kingston?
I'm in Kingston, yes.
Michael Lodge is Secretary General of the International Seabed Authority, the body that governs the global seabed. This kind of mining is still just in the exploratory stage. Companies need a sponsor for their trials, a state that has ratified the law of the sea, which isn't everyone.
The U.S. is one of the few countries that remains outside the Law of the Sea Convention, along with countries like North Korea and Colombia.
For its deep sea venture, U.S. company Lockheed Martin is going through its subsidiary in the U.K. The U.K. is party to the Law of the Sea. Once a company has a proper sponsor and has passed a lot of tests, it can get an exploratory contract and take the plunge.
We're talking about 3 miles below the surface of the Pacific Ocean.
Samantha Smith is a scientist at deep sea mining company GSR. It's sponsored by Belgium. Smith says her mining company is looking for something called polymetallic nodules.
These metal-rich accretions, they look like rocks to you and me.
These nodules form over millions of years. They're about the size of a potato, and they're full of cobalt, nickel, manganese, copper. The four minerals that on land usually come from multiple mines are all in one place here.
The exact metals we need for a clean energy transition.
Smith sent me some photos from GSR's latest deep sea exploration this spring.
Yep. So that first photo that you're looking at.
GSR's deep sea mining process involves a large robot with several long hoses.
Okay. So those hoses you see at the front.
Right.
How that works is very much like a vacuum where they suck up the nodules.
But the prospect of robotic vacuums crawling around the ocean floor has raised environmental concerns. More than 500 scientists and marine policy experts have called for more research into potential impacts on species and habitat loss, the fish we eat, even the way the ocean sequesters carbon.
Those are serious unanswered questions staring at us in the face.
Douglas McCauley is one of those scientists. The UC Santa Barbara professor says he's worried the mining could threaten a wide variety of sea life.
You may disrupt the health and functioning of that entire ecosystem.
Google and Volvo are among companies already saying they won't use metals from the deep seabed. The International Seabed Authority says it's continuing to develop regulations for the mining industry. Here's Michael Lodge.
You have a lot of engineers working with the scientists to try to find ways to design the equipment in such a way that it has the least possible impact.
Proponents of deep sea mining say that compared to mining on land, there's no deforestation. They point out that companies in metal-rich countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo have been accused of human rights abuses, like using child labor. While the potential impacts of deep sea mining are still unknown, the climate crisis is here, and demand for these metals is coming. Simon Morris, formerly of Wood Mackenzie, estimates we'll need almost triple the current global supply of cobalt, for example, to reach even modest climate goals.
We fundamentally scratch our heads as to where this could come from.
He says industry is going to have to invest at least $2 trillion over the next 20 years to supply the metals needed to support the energy transition. I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, news of two departures at the Federal Reserve. You might have heard the last 10 days, 2 weeks, and on this program on Friday, about some securities trading that two regional Fed bank presidents have done over the past year, Rob Kaplan at the Dallas Fed and Eric Rosengren at the Boston Fed. Trading that was done while the Fed was getting much more deeply involved in the economy than it had been. Anyway, not a great look. Fed Chair Jay Powell expressly did not say he had confidence in the two at his press conference last week. And today both announced their retirement. Kaplan straight up, Rosengren for health reasons. All right, we got to go, but not before your moment of economic context in which the consumer-driven economy keeps ripping along. We learned this morning durable goods orders, big expensive stuff built to last, was up almost 2% August over July. That's refrigerators and cars and computers and stuff. But also factory orders for stuff to make all that consumer stuff. Funny how that worked, isn't it? Oh, man. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Honhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.